From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Summer's here. What to read? A good book, or two, or three, or five, can make the season really sing, give it that extra depth and range and sizzle. We've got three great readers with suggestions for you. This hour On Point, great summer books for 2015. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's on your list for this summer? What do you need? What are your recommendations? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. To our readers, joining us from New York is Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review. Lauren, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kevin Nguyen is with us, editorial director at Oyster, the app for discovering and reading books on your smartphone, tablet, or web browser. He runs the Oyster Review, an online books magazine from the editorial arm of Oyster. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Miami, Christina Nosti joins us from Books and Books, the locally owned bookstore with three locations in South Florida, Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year. Christina Nosti, welcome to you.
Hola, Tom.
Hola. Hola. Thank you so much for being here. Let's start off with just understanding so we can look at your list. And by the way, I should say we've got top 10 from each of these at our website, onpointradio.org. You can check them all out there. Christina, when it comes to a summer book, what are you looking for? Let us understand the way you navigate these waters.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people think about summer as like the beach read, the chick lit, you know, the easy breezy read.
Yep.
And I look at summer as a time for like really digging into my books, because it's when my life slows down a little bit.
Yep.
And when I go on vacation. So for me, it's a time to really read the books I love.
So a deep dig in the books for summer. I know we've all got them piled up on the shelves or with the dust bunnies under the bed waiting for a free week or a slower time that if it's ever going to come, it comes in summer. Lauren, what do you look for in a summer read? Do you make a seasonal distinction, Lauren?
I completely agree with Christina. There's a whole stack of books on my desk at work that's just waiting for summer, and they're not the easiest. They're the ones that I really want to give time to.
So we've got some serious summer readers here. Kevin, what's your strategy?
I like to move pretty quickly through books in the summer. I like to feel like I'm getting things done on the beach. But I also like things that are kind of dark and gritty.
Take us right in then. So you want to go through a little quicker, like butter. I don't know. Eileen is at the top of your book list for this summer. But I don't know how to pronounce this. Otessa Moshfegh?
Otessa Moshfegh?
What's Eileen?
Eileen is a literary thriller. So Otessa is a debut author. And actually, Lauren can probably tell you all about her, too. She's relatively unknown aside from her work in the Paris Review, and she's the winner of the Paris Review's Plimpton Prize.
Oh, no less.
So Eileen takes place in this terrible small town outside of Boston that's just anonymously referred to as Xville, and she works at a boys' prison. And she has a cop for a father who's an alcoholic. And this book, it just takes place over the course of a week, and it charts her escape from this town. And at the center of it is this crime. And it's not really revealed until later in the book what the crime is, but it's moody, it's dark, and, you know, Moshfegh just shows great restraint and narrative control. It's like a near-perfect piece of literary suspense.
Literary suspense. Eileen, the main character here, has an aversion to personal hygiene, I read. What's that about?
I don't want to spoil too much. It's pretty gross.
Lauren, your magazine brought her to public attention with the Plimpton Prize. How did she get your accolades?
A friend sent me a couple of stories of hers, and they were just some of the best stories I've read by a young writer, well, by anyone in a few years. She's just really special. And one thing that Kevin mentioned is that the voice of this character is just absolutely believable, and that's true in all of her fiction. Her narrators are real people.
She's looking back from a 50-year perspective on her youth when she was maybe getting ready to plot her exodus from this little New England town. Kevin, could you read a little bit for us from the Otessa Moshfegh's book, Eileen?
Yes, absolutely. I will say this about houses. Those perfect, neat colonials I'd passed earlier that evening on my way through Xville are the death masks of normal people. Nobody is really so orderly, so perfect. To have a house like that says more about what's wrong with you than any decrepit dump. Those people with perfect houses are simply obsessed with death. A house that is so well-maintained, furnished with good-looking furniture of high quality, decorated tastefully, everything in its place, becomes a living tomb. People truly engaged in life have messy houses. I knew this implicitly at age 24. Of course, at 24, I was also obsessed with death.
That from Eileen by Tessa Moschweg. At the top of the list of Kevin Nguyen, you can see everybody's full list at our website, onpointradio.org. Christina Nasty in Miami, let us come to yours. You come to a musician here who's writing his own story, Philip Glass, in Words Without Music, a memoir from the great composer we've spoken with wonderfully on this show. But you put his memoir at the top of your list. What takes it there, Christina?
Well, I don't think there's anyone in the world who hasn't heard of Philip Glass. And even if you're not a fan of his music, you've definitely heard of him. He's world-renowned and, in my opinion, a true artist. And lo and behold, he's also a remarkably gifted writer. All of his behind-the-scenes recollections, everything that he shares with us in this book, in his autobiography, traces his life from his childhood in post-World War II Baltimore. He's the son of a record store owner, his student days in Chicago at Juilliard, his first journey to Paris, and then, of course, all these wonderful collaborations that he did with Allen Ginsberg, Ravi Shankar, Robert Wilson, Martin Scorsese, and many others. So I look at this book as a window into his interior life. And certainly, even if you're not interested in music or in his music, it's about the shaping of an artist, how, you know, aesthetic epiphanies, philosophy, spirituality. There's a lot about Buddhism in the book because he founded
recounts going to India looking for a kind of a guru there.
Exactly. And he finds Ravi Shankar, and it just like ignites his whole life and is a revelation to him.
Writes about the years when he worked as a mover, a plumber, a taxi driver to keep his family fed. Do you end up caring about Philip Glass not just as an artist but as a person in this memoir, Christina?
Absolutely. He's hilarious. He's touching. He's profound. I love this book.
Lauren Stein, take us to the top of your list. It's kind of a Back to the Future, a reprint here from decades ago that makes your number one.
Well, yeah, and it's one of Kevin's favorites, too. I'm really curious. We didn't get a chance to talk about it yet. I want to hear what he thinks
Good.
About it.
Introduce us. This is Talk okay. by Linda Rosenkrantz. It's a reprint from 1968. How does it make the top of your list in 2015?
Well, the wonderful New York Review classics, everything that they republish is worthy of interest. I'm always curious to see what they're coming out with. It's always stuff I've never heard of. And in this case, it's a novel made up entirely in dialogue between two women, best friends, and Marcia and Emily, and a friend of theirs, Vincent, a close friend of Marcia's, a gay guy. And the three of them, most of it happens on the beach in East Hampton. And it's just about them yakking about being in their late 20s. And the cover copy compares it to Girls, the TV show. And I think there's something to that. I also thought of Sheila Hedy, a young writer now who works a lot with found dialogue. Apparently, the book was cobbled together from hundreds of conversations with a bunch of different people, but now with each line assigned to one of three characters. And it's fun. They talk about sex, psychoanalysis, LSD. It's a real 60s book.
They talk a lot about sex.
A lot.
It's funny. I think like the comparison to Girls now is just emblazoned on anything where women just talk frankly about sex.
Yes.
It just shows how uncommon that is. You know?
That's true.
How does the 60s-ness of it show up, Lauren? Do you feel like you read a historical document in Talk by Linda Rosenkrantz, like people talking from another era, another age, another sensibility?
That's definitely part of the attraction, at least for me, is it's so much fun to hear, you know, we all sit around and talk a lot of nonsense all the time. That's just the way humans interact with each other. And it's so much fun to hear the nonsense of a little while ago because it sounds kind of like ours, but they're talking about psychoanalysis or Kevin, help me out.
Kevin, what drew you to it?
It just moves very quickly. And it just reminded me, it's funny, Ann Arbor Classics, one of probably the best publishers out there, it reminded me a lot of Renata Adler's Speedboat, which is also written probably in the 70s.
In the 70s.
And it just, the way it's written is just, it moves so quickly and so frankly that it still feels very modern. And I kind of expected there to be a lot more, you know, like 50s and 60s slang in Talk, but it still feels pretty contemporary to me.
Put it up against another that's high on your list, Kevin, and that is Barbara the Slut and Other People by Lauren Holmes. You've got 10 first-person narratives in here, millennials, I guess, talking about their circumstances, a lab technician at an STD clinic sort of stalling out, a law school grad who can't think what she wants to do with her life, working in a sex toy store. Put, if you compare them, the sort of attitude, world outlook, or even the appeal of the book, how would you compare them?
Not too dissimilar. I mean, similarly, Barbara the Slut is really, it's a debut story collection that is about young women wrestling with being young women. You know, the title story is about a Princeton-bound high schooler who is bullied and slut-shamed. And, you know, these are things that we talk about pretty regularly now, but, you know, they're issues that have always existed. But what Lauren Holmes does very cleverly is she just couches all these devastating revelations about self and family and relationships with such a levity and a sense of humor. I think one of my favorite stories from the book is actually from the perspective of a dog. And the dog is just used to chart the relationship of these two people from beginning to end.
Christina Nasti, Publishers Weekly, says you have the best bookstore in the world. Does a book entitled Barbara the Slut sell? Do you put that up front by the cash register? Does that work these days?
It's a good choice. We don't necessarily put it up by the register, but it would work for us. Yes, it works for us. Definitely.
And what do you see moving so far? We are just about to tip formally into summer here. What's the appetite seem to be? Yours is serious and deep. What about your customers? Where are they going for this summer?
They're serious and deep, too. All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winner. Dead Wake by Eric Larson. H is for Hawk. Being Mortal by the great Atul Gawande. Euphoria by Lily King. The Children Act by Ian McEwan. And then, of course, there's Dave Barry and all of his books and his new kids' book. Brad Meltzer's new adult book called The President's Shadow. And then anything by Elena Ferrante, who is the mysterious Italian novelist who no one knows if she's a man or a woman, but people are just like eating up her novels.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about great summer reads books 2015 with three savvy, omnivorous readers. Lauren Stein is with us, editor of the Paris Review, joins us today from New York. Also from New York, Kevin Nguyen. He is editorial director at Oyster, the sort of Spotify for books. They've got a editorial side there, the Oyster Review, online books magazine. Kevin brings us his top 10 for this summer. Christina Nasti is with us from Miami, Florida. She's at Books and Books, Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year this year. We've got a top 10 from each of these three. You can see those at our website, onpointradio.org. Just sneaking on to Lauren Stein's at number 10, we've got a little sound from Paul Beatty. He is author of The Sellout. In March of this year, he talked with us about his newest book, The Sellout. Here he is reading a little selection from that book. The main character, Bon Bon, is put in an application to find a sister city for his town, Dickens. It's a fictional town on the outskirts of Los Angeles. The city match consultant, Mrs. Silverman, informs Bon Bon that three cities have rejected their request, including Juarez, Mexico, Chernobyl, and Kinshasa. Paul Beatty reads for us.
Kinshasa of the Democratic Republic of Congo? Don't tell me. Kinshasa, the poorest city in the poorest country in the world, a place where the average per capita income is one goat bell, two bootleg Michael Jackson cassette tapes, and three sips of potable water per year, thinks we're too poor to associate with. No, they think Dickens is too black.
Dickens is too black. Lauren Stein, this makes it onto your list, The Sellout by Paul Beatty, and the little town in California that's too black to find a sister city in the world. Even Kinshasa says no thank you.
That's right. This is such a funny book. Paul's books are all really funny. I mean, I think the best one known before this was White Boy Shuffle, but The Sellout is, it's, the plot doesn't really hang together. You can't talk about it that way because it's pretty absurd, but it's one deep, smart riff after another, and it's set in this neighborhood in Watts that's been given over, that's been zoned for agriculture. Apparently such a place actually exists, and it's lost its designation as a city, and the hero is trying to put it back on the map. But he gets into legal trouble because he Well, for really complicated reasons. He's a black guy, and he owns a slave who who was the last of the black children playing on Little Rascals, our gang. So a younger contemporary of Buckwheat and Stymie.
So we're getting...
It's a hard book to describe.
It's into satirical territory here in a hurry.
We sure are. We sure are.
Sell out by Paul Beatty. Christina Nasty, take us on down your list. The Fall of Princes, as in the plural of the male, prince.
It's the great Robbie Gulrich's newest book. I'm such a fan of his work. And in a lot of ways, this book, it's a morality tale. It's set in the 1980s in Manhattan. It's about a group of young Wall Street Turks that reach the pinnacle, achieve everything they've ever wanted in terms of money and power, and then one by one, they fall. And it's very seductive, razor sharp. It's mostly about redemption, which kind of links it to A Reliable Wife. And also his wonderful memoir, The End of the World as We Know It, which, in my opinion, is one of the best memoirs I've ever read, about the persistence of song. And basically, that's how we all have it within ourselves to be both monsters and also angels.
We get that. You want to read a little bit for us from Robert Gulrich's The Fall of Princes here? You've got this young, wealthy, arrogant Wall Street trader, lives large, and then it all burns out. Could you read for us, Christina?
I chose the very first, the opening paragraph to read, and the chapter is called The Invention of Money. When you strike a match, it burns brighter in the first nanosecond than it will ever burn again, that first incandescence, that instantaneous and brilliant flash. 1980 was the year, and I was the match, and that was the year I struck into blinding flame. I was a heat-seeking missile headed straight for your gut. Get out of the way, or I would take you down. I swear, I'm not proud of it. In fact, I flush with shame at the memory. But that was then what then was like. Things are very different now. I'm not that person anymore.
Christina Nosti reading there from Robert Gulrich's The Fall of Princes. Lots of callers for all three of you. Full top 10 lists at our website, onpointradio.org. If you're looking for this summer's read, there's a good chance you'll find it right there. Sue in Atlanta, Georgia. Sue, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I really agree with what the callers are saying about I'm a retired teacher, and when I was a teacher, I definitely, every summer, would say, okay, this is the summer I'm going to read War and Peace. You know,
take on a big classic. Yeah, yeah. What about now,
anyway,
Sue?
I like everything, and I do tend to read things that are tougher because I'm a slow reader, so it takes me a while to get through them. And I did love All the Light We Cannot See. I mean, that was my favorite book this year. But I'm reading another one that's really like a great companion novel called The Invisible Bridge by Julie Oringer, and I think it's her first novel. She's written short stories before. But it's also World War II era. It's set partly in Paris and partly in Hungary, and it's great.
There's a thumbs up for Invisible Bridge by Julie Oringer from Sue in Atlanta. Enjoy, Sue. Enjoy all the summer's reading. One more right here from New Orleans, if I may. Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask for some recommendations for reading. My interests are in Southern Gothic novels and in crime fiction or noir books. Y'all got any recommendations for me?
Let's put it to our panel. Southern Gothic, noir, crime fiction. Christina, may I come to you? Do you have suggestions for Chris in New Orleans? He's from New Orleans, so he's going to have a high bar here for you.
Okay. Well, not all of those genres are genres that I read a lot. But this is not a new book. But if you're into crime fiction, Kate Atkinson's Case Histories is phenomenal because it's outside the box. There's another, all of Joe Nesbo's books, the thrillers.
The Scandinavian crime novels.
Correct. Those are all terrific reads.
Where does Kate Atkinson set her novels? I know Nesbo. His are up, in Sweden, Finland, Norway region. But what about Kate?
Honestly, if you kill me now, I can't remember. I read the book a long time ago.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter where they're set. But actually, I do think it might be the South.
Now we're getting into crime territory. Do we kill you now in the middle of a talk radio show because you can't come up with it? No. Lauren Stein, Kevin, have you got crime, noir, Southern Gothic suggestions here for our New Orleans caller?
Yeah, I mean, I double down on Eileen. And also, I think my favorite thriller from last summer was The Fever by Megan Abbott, which is about this small town. I think also in New England, I'm sensing a theme here. Where this it's about this group of high school girls, and they all start having these seizures, and people in the town, it's kind of about hysteria. It's also about sort of the psychic wounds that high school girls inflict on each other. And they're just trying to figure out, you know, is this a disease? Is this, you know, something mystical? Is it just nothing? It's an absolutely delightful thriller.
And I have a Southern recommendation.
Yes, please, Lord.
It's not brand new, but it's in paperback. It's called Pulphead. And it's by actually the Southern editor of the Paris Review, John Jeremiah Sullivan. It's a collection of essays that are, a lot of them are about what it's like to be in the South today. And it is one of my favorite books of essays. And I don't say that because he's a colleague at the Review. a colleague at the Review probably because he's so great.
Do a little creative transliteration for us here off your list. If Chris is, or triangulation, if Chris is in New Orleans and he likes Southern Gothic and noir and crime fiction, look down your top 10, Lauren. I don't see any of those exactly, but what might come the closest to pleasing this palette?
Well, maybe Coup de Foudre, the novella and stories by Ken Kalfas. The title story, Coup de Foudre, is told from the point of view of a man who's committed a sexual assault, and the man is obviously based on Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and it tries to get into the question of why a person who's so powerful might have taken advantage of someone so powerless.
And in general, talking about the attack in the hotel room in New York that caused him to sort of tumble down.
Yeah, the alleged and alleged, in some ways, mysterious attack. Mm-hmm. And so Ken really gets inside the head of this villainous, powerful, but in certain ways sympathetic man. And all of his stories are full of that kind of sympathy.
You've got a little reading for us here from Coup de Foudre by Ken Kalfas. Could you set this reading up for us? What's going on here?
Sure. This is a story called Mercury. This actually ran in the Paris Review. Mm-hmm. It's a story told by a school teacher who, long after he's been fired from his job back in the early 60s, he was a school teacher, and he's looking back and trying to figure out how it happened that some compromising information about him got out. And in that effort, he puts himself in the head of a little kid with whom he clearly identifies, a kid named Sammy, who's supposed to take a note from him down to another teacher in a different hall.
Great, let's hear it.
So here it is. Sammy could not bear the prospect of speaking his name. His name was a disgrace. He gazed across the room, focusing on a poster that illustrated the design of the new Mercury space capsule, the one-man vehicle that in orbit was an empire of perfect isolation. He recognized, sitting at desks below the poster, two or three of the fifth graders, big brother versions of boys his own age, who were indefatigably tormented by them. They looked at him with killing hostility. Several back row girls grimaced in disdain, gum chewing, hair teased, sharp tongued fifth grade harlots. They were widely deemed capable of adult perversions. One whispered to her neighbor, the others giggled. This confirmed, as if confirmation were needed, that something was wrong with Sammy. He would spend the rest of his life trying to figure out what it was.
From Coup de Foudre by Ken Kalfas. Foudre as in sudden, amazing event.
Lightning bolt. Yeah.
Lightning bolt. Yes, a lightning bolt, no less. Jenny in Claremore, Oklahoma. Jenny, thank you for calling. You're on the air with our panel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
Well, I wanted to share my book reading experience this summer that we have planned in our family.
Yes.
My daughter is a freshman in high school, and she read the classic To Kill a Mockingbird by Hopper
Lee. Of course, sure.
And I read it in high school. Well, I'm going to reread that, and then together we're going to read the book Ghost at a Watchman that's coming out this summer. After 50-some-odd years, so we're kind of excited to digest it and tear it apart together and go over both books, so it'll be fun.
You and a whole lot of others, I'm imagining, Jenny, and I like the idea of a mother-daughter reading of To Kill a Mockingbird and then Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Of course, The emergence of that manuscript and its publication has had a fair amount of controversy around it. I don't know if any of you, Christina, Kevin, Lauren, have read Go Set a Watchman. I've seen early publication of it. Does anybody have an opinion on it? We don't want to break anybody's bubble here in Oklahoma. Anybody read it?
No, I think it's on lockdown.
Still on lockdown entirely?
I think it's still embargoed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, okay.
Christina, did they send it to
are?
You?
Nope. But we are celebrating the publication at Books and Books with a screening of To Kill a Mockingbird and authors, local authors, who the book means a lot to, the film and the book. And we're tying it into the whole idea of like Black Lives Matter. And I think it's going to be a beautiful thing. Very, very timely.
I love it. And I love it. Jenny's attitude there in Oklahoma. She and her daughter are ready to tear it apart when they get into Go Set a Watchman. You've got a little reading from H is for Hawk for us, Christina. Tell us about that book. It got a lot of attention this year. Helen MacDonald's book. Her father had died. She was grieving and looking for a way out of that grief. Tell us a little bit and give us a read.
This book is really hard to describe. Whenever I try to sell it, I hold the book in my hand. It's got a beautiful cover. It just says H is for Hawk, and it has a big hawk on it. And then I try to tell people what it's about. And basically, yes, it's about a woman whose dad dies suddenly. She's grieving. She's a falconer. And so she decides that she is going to train the most difficult kind of hawk, the goshawk.
Mm-hmm.
And she embarks on this journey with this hawk, but also is interjecting a lot of about T.H. White's life. He was the author of The Once and Future King.
Yes.
He was also a falconer. And basically, he was a closeted gay man. And it's like a very stream of consciousness. She's a poet, and it's incredibly poetic, but also so you learn so much in this book.
Christina, dive in and read. Our clock is ticking down to the break. Go.
Absolutely. To train a hawk, you must watch it like a hawk, and so you come to understand its moods. Then you gain the ability to predict what it will do next. This is the sixth sense of the practiced animal trainer. Eventually, you don't see the hawk's body language at all. You seem to feel what it feels, notice what it notices. The hawk's apprehension becomes your own. You are exercising what the poet Keats called your chameleon quality, the ability to tolerate a loss of self and a loss of rationality by trusting in the capacity to recreate oneself in another character or environment. Such a feat of imaginative recreation has always come easily to me.
From Helen MacDonald, H is for Hawk. Did you come to understand this as a process or path for dealing with grief?
Did I? Yes.
Yes.
Definitely. It's about getting out of yourself and getting losing yourself in something else to forget and basically to deal.
Kevin, we've got a minute and a half before the break. Hold Still by Sally Mann, the famous photographer who photographed her children, sometimes controversially, in the nude and more. But it's on your list right up there, very high. Why?
Yeah, it's terrific. I mean, it talks very intensely about that controversy. Sally Mann, a photographer, her controversial third book, Immediate Family, featured photographs of young children in the nude. So she handles that in the book as well. She talks about her critics, but Still Life is really mostly a family history. And in the framing of it is it's assembled from old memories and old photographs, and it just possesses this great creative spirit and kind of that name-droppy joy of Patti Smith's kids.
What a great book that was. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Anything Patti Smith writes, I'll go to. Lauren, give us 2 seconds on another of yours. A hand reached down to guide me. David Gates.
David Gates. A lot of stories about men who made terrible choices in their lives and are trying to make good. And he's really, really funny about failure. No one writes better about failure than David Gates.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great summer reads, books for 2015 with three very savvy, omnivorous, well-plugged-in readers. Christina Nosti is with us from Miami, Florida. She's at Books and Books, Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year for 2015. Knows something about books down there. Lauren Stein in New York is editor of the Paris Review and joins us with his top 10. Kevin Nguyen is with us from Oyster, the Oyster Review. Oyster, kind of Spotify for books online. Oyster Review, the editorial arm there. They all each have their top 10 faves suggestions at our website, onpointradio.org. Check them out there. We're also collecting yours as we hear them on the air, and we will put those up as well. People writing in with favorites already. Pat says, The Book of Aaron by Jim Shepherd, the best author you've never heard of. Peter says, Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. Seven Eves, it looks sort of like. Classic sci-fi, a modern foundation. Mish says, El Defo for young readers. She's a teacher, reads all of her fifth and sixth grade students' books from the past and coming year. El Defo. Leonard rereads Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine every summer. Here's Peasy Notes says, what this changes everything, Capitalism versus the Climate by Naomi Klein. Right off the fiction shelf into nonfiction, we've got David McCullough's book on the Wright brothers mentioned here. And Nell helpfully writes in, Christina, that Kate Atkinson's books are all set in the UK. And Nell writes, and all wonderful, with three exclamation marks. Listeners, you can join us. Are you lined up for Jane Smiley this summer, or T.C. Boyle, or Ann Beatty, Judy Blume, Philip Glass? Do you only read 50 Shades now, E.L. James, Gray, the latest out? What's the subject, the theme, the genre, the tune, the tone that calls to you this summer? Catherine in Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm looking for some kind of an epic series along the lines of Game of Thrones, just to really get my to sink my teeth into. I like sci-fi, but not the kind of hardcore sci-fi. I like it to be grounded with somewhat real characters and storylines. So, like, for instance, the last few years, my favorite books have been The Game of Thrones, but also Justin Cronin's The Passage trilogy. So kind of something like that long, you know, you can really get stuck into and lost in.
Get stuck, get lost. Great epic story. Christina, Lauren, Kevin, suggestion for Catherine in Lexington, Kentucky?
Well
Christina,
I've got a...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
A recommendation. Mm-hmm. Philip Pullman, his Dark Materials trilogy, I think would appeal to you.
Okay.
They're books to really sink into. It's the books that the Golden Compass, there's three of them.
Oh, yeah.
It was not a great film, but these books are just a joy to read, and they will keep you going. You will not want to stop.
Philip Pullman's Dark Materials. Other suggestions there?
Well, I was just thinking, because Christina mentioned T.H. White. Mm-hmm. This is an older book, but The Once and Future King is actually a series, and it has the Book of Merlin. And I went back and reread it a couple of summers ago, and it's partly written for kids, but not really, really. And it's just so deep and funny and imaginative. I think if I wanted to read a fantasy series, that's the place I would start.
Lauren Stein,
Once in Future King changed my life. It was one of my favorite books.
Pretty great. There's a lot of room to get lost there for anybody in Lexington, Kentucky or beyond. Jane Smiley's latest makes your list, Lauren Stein. It's called Early Warning. Tell us about it.
It's another epic, and I was going to suggest it until Game of Thrones came up, because it's not like that. It's an epic that starts in 1920 and will end with Volume 3, which isn't out yet, in 2020. And it covers 100 years in the life of the Langdon family, a family of Midwestern farmers who then become other things as the years go by. And each chapter is a year, and you follow the points of views of babies who then you watch turn into old people. And I heard Jane Smiley say the other day that the tricky thing was figuring out how to kill them. And I thought she meant it first because she got attached to the characters. She said, no, I just had to come up with a lot of different ways for them to die.
Oh, geez.
But it's just completely absorbing. I felt that I knew these characters as well as I knew my own family. I wept. Three hanky books.
There you go.
I laughed a lot.
Jane Smiley's latest early warning. Kevin Nguyen, you've got In the Country, Stories by Mia Alvar. Tell us about Mia. I don't know this author. Where's she from? What's she writing here?
This is her first book. It's actually out as of this Tuesday.
Brand new.
Yeah, In the Country. It actually takes place in many countries. Mm-hmm. It's these nine transcontinental stories of Filipinos living in the Philippines, in America, in Saudi Arabia. And it just takes a wide breadth of characters, from school teachers to journalists to models. And I think the thing that ties all these stories together is this sense of compassion and the way that distance, whether it's geographic or emotional, can deeply affect familial and romantic ties.
Many can relate to that in this era of globalization. Drew in Charlotte, North Carolina. Drew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. When I heard you guys mention H's for Hawk, I just had to call in. I read that book a couple months ago after hearing it on Here and Now, actually.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's a great book, whether you like memoirs or falconry or being outside or anything. I think a lot of people will enjoy reading it and can kind of learn something about it.
Not that many people have a lot of experience with falconry. How does it grab you, Drew?
Well, I train animals as well, and so hearing her talk about it, I mean, not falcons, but which would be just too cool for words.
Yes.
But hearing her talk about it from there and be very poetic about it, of course I've read T.H. White since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I had no idea about his struggle, so that was very intriguing too. So I think whether you like what kind of books you like, fiction or nonfiction, got some for everybody. Highly recommend it.
Drew, you are an intriguing man. What animals do you train, sir?
I train dogs, actually, and I've actually talked to you before about this when Ann Patchett was on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Long time ago. But anyway, so it was just very cool to hear her be so poetic about it, you know, and a lot of grief in that book, too, and how she comes through it is just very cool. You know, I wasn't grieving at the time, but I can understand that if someone was, it could be very therapeutic for them, so... Very cool book.
You've got my attention, Drew, and I love the notion of a dog trainer diving into the work of a falconer. I'm picturing some kind of Greek mythological creature coming out of that association. Charlie, thank you, Drew, in Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlie in Arlington, Massachusetts. Charlie, you're on.
Hi. I'd like to recommend some books, some works of nonfiction.
Yes, please.
Right now I'm in the middle of the first volume of Rick Atkinson's Liberation Trilogy, The Day of Battle.
World War II is beginning. We've talked with Rick about that. He's terrific. Are you enjoying it?
I'm enjoying it greatly. The pacing is terrific. The writing is elegant, frequently witty. The pen portraits are extremely effective. If anyone's looking for a great long read for the summer, altogether the three books make up about 1,800 pages. I would strongly recommend this trilogy.
What else nonfiction, Charlie?
Nonfiction. Okay. So I have Hampton Sides' new book, In the Kingdom of Ice, on
He's
my
great.
Desk. I've read all of his other books. I'm looking forward to reading this one.
Love him.
He's a wonderful, wonderful stylist, a great storyteller, incapable of writing a dull sentence.
Takes you there. Hampton Sides never fails. True.
And finally, Patrick Leefermer, the great English travel writer, never completed in his lifetime the third volume of his account of his walk across Europe in the 1930s. At the age of 18, he began a walk in the Hook of Holland all the way to Istanbul, and he went through countries that were strongly affected by various forms of fascism. He was
sure.
in Germany shortly after Hitler came to power. He gives an account of all of this in the first two volumes. People didn't know if the third volume would ever be written. It has been put together. It's a posthumous version by NYRB. Someone mentioned their books earlier. So I'm looking forward to reading the third volume of his account of walking across Europe in the 30s, as well as a new biography of Patrick Leefermer called Leefermer, An Adventure, by Artemus Cooper. So these are the works of nonfiction that I'm reading and looking forward to reading.
You've taken us on a wonderful tour of imagination right there, Charlie, from the real world, and I appreciate your call very much. Let's look at some nonfiction on the list of my guests. Kevin, you've got a couple here, The Dark Net, Inside the Digital Underworld, and How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and Patient Zero of Privacy. Stephen Witt and Jamie Bartlett. Tell us about those two, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people, I spend all day looking at the internet, so then I go home and then I read books about the internet. We'll start with How Music Got Free by Stephen Witt. This just came out this week also, but it's this really great Swift history of music piracy. And I think what's kind of amazing about it is we think about, you know, Napster and just like piracy was everywhere, but it really came down to the beginning with this one guy, Del Glover, who was a factory worker at a CD plant in North Carolina, and he was just basically responsible for almost every major album leak that came out in the early 2000s. So it's a great portrait of him, and it's a very human book. And I think what's most impressive, it spends a lot of time talking about music execs, and it makes even music execs seem sympathetic.
And The Dark Net, will I understand Bitcoin and Silk Road after I read The Dark Net?
You know, I understood Bitcoin while I read it, but don't ask me to explain it again. Silk Road, it's, you know, the kind of the black mark of the internet. I love The Dark Net. It's all over the place. It's in all these dark recesses of the web. And I don't know if you watch House of Cards, just imagine the deep web plot line from House of Cards, only, you know, someone's explaining it. It makes the slightest bit of sense.
Lauren Stein, take us on down your list. We're not going to make it to all 10 on air here. The clock is working on us. Give us another couple from your list and tell us about them.
I would say that the most unlikely looking one that I can't recommend highly enough is a book called The Age of the Crisis of Man by Mark Greif. He's a founding editor at the magazine N+1, but by night he's a scholar. And this is about all those books, Wither Man, The End of Man, One Dimensional Man, books that came out in mid-century about this perceived problem that humanity was somehow endangered. And he takes this relatively obscure question and then turns it into a fascinating investigation of what happened to the idea of the intellectual, what happened to the great idea of the great American novel, a lot of things that we've said goodbye to without knowing we were saying goodbye to. It's a terrific book about multiculturalism, and it's the kind of book that you say what it's really about is this, and then you think, no, what it's really about is that.
That's such a high bar of ambition. Does he clear it, Lauren? It makes your list, and high, he must.
I walked around feeling as though scales had fallen from my eyes.
Wow.
I thought it was just terrific.
Fantastic.
And I finally understood the books that were sitting on my parents' shelves that they hadn't read since college.
The Age of the Crisis of Man by Mark Greif. I love it. Yes,
I would
Christina.
Add one nonfiction to that list.
Mm-hmm.
Water to the Angels, William Mulholland, His Monumental Aqueduct, and the Rise of Los Angeles by Les Standiford. And I think the best way to describe this book is that it's the real story of the movie Chinatown. All the real stuff that happened right after the turn of the 20th century, about 30 years before Polanski's film.
Does it make it a favorite film, just a great, great film? Does this book have all the more resonance with what's going on with water in California right now? After all, Mulholland was the one who brought all that water to L.A., but it was so epic, and now it's a little iffy.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Taylor in Charleston, South Carolina. Taylor, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to call. I just finished the book, The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd.
The Secret Life of Bees author?
Yes, yes. It's a really fantastic story about Sarah Grimke and one of her slaves growing up. Her name is Handful. It tells both sides of the story, the perspective of a white young slave owner who detests slavery, and a young girl who is born into slavery and how she grows up and copes with it.
The Invention of Wings from Sue Monk Kidd, who wrote The Secret Life of Bees. Terrific. Taylor, thank you so much. Kevin, Barbarian Days. I read a little of this. This is from William Finnegan. I think I read an excerpt in The New Yorker recently about surfing. He spent much of his life surfing all over the world. It makes your list pretty high. Barbarian Days. Tell us.
Yeah, like you said, it's a surfing memoir. William Finnegan is a longtime New Yorker writer, and kind of starts with him growing up in Hawaii, and surfing just takes him around the world. And it's just a great summer read. It's long, but there's just a lot of this boyish energy and charm. There's this specifically great scene where he's taking LSD while surfing in Maui.
Christina, give us a couple more. In the Unlikely Event from Judy Blume. We're talking with her next week. Tell us about that. And also Chantel Acevedo's The Distant Marvels.
Sure. We just hosted Judy a couple of days ago, and she's phenomenal. And there's a reason why she's revered. And I think a lot of it, and there's a reason why she looks 10 years, at least 10 years younger than she actually is. And I think it's because she's so connected to this, like, very fresh part of yourself, like, from your youth.
And this is not a children's book, though, in The Unlikely Event.
It's not a children's book, but it has a lot of emotional resonance. Mm-hmm. It has a huge cast of characters, and it's based on her own teenage years in growing up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, when three planes crashed all within the span of like a few weeks and changed everybody's lives. And so although it's kind of heavy subject matter, it's called In the Unlikely Event, it's really about how people get through tragedy and how it transforms everyone in this community.
And The Distant Marvels, Chantel Acevedo?
I remember Lester Gorin, who was the director of the creative writing department at the University of Miami, talking to me years ago about a student of his and saying how he really thought that this student just was such a promising voice, and that was Chantel Acevedo. And she is second-generation Cuban-American. And this book is about an old woman who was a lectora, like a reader, mm-hmm. in a cigar factory. And it's set in 1963 during Hurricane Flora. They're swept away. They have to spend time together in a mansion. And she begins telling stories. And it's all about the history of Cuba. It's phenomenal.
I just love the idea of a lectora, the one who reads to the cigar rollers, telling a mm-hmm. story anywhere to them. Lauren, we're greedy. Give us a little bit on one more. This new noise about the BBC, we've got 20 seconds, Lauren.
If you like public radio, you gotta understand the history of the BBC and all the problems it's having now. Charlotte Higgins is a cultural writer for The Guardian. She did a 9-part series, turned it into this book. It's fascinating. Couldn't put it down.
This new noise, The Extraordinary Birth and Troubled Life of the BBC. Yes, we do like public radio, by Charlotte Higgins. Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review, joining us today from New York. You're terrific and you're generous. Thank you very much for sharing your top 10 summer reads with us, Lauren.
Thank you.
Kevin Nguyen with the Oyster Review. Kevin, thanks for yours as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Christina Nosti at Books and Books in Miami. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you, Tom.
It's all at the website. This is On Point.